Okay, so last time we started discussing the Jellium model. And let me repeat the assumption that this model makes. So we are going to assume that all the ions in the solid, they are replaced. So the ions give rise to a periodic potential, but we are going to replace that periodic potential by a uniform charged background, which is denoted here. So the electrons in this model will be treated quantum mechanically, but they don't see the periodic potential. They see this uniform charge density. One thing that I tried to do last time was treating ions quantum mechanically using field operators, but with this, this is not the spirit of, that was not the spirit of Jellium model. We'll treat electrons in terms of these field operators. All the field operators for ions, they are replaced by this uniform charge density. So for example, look at this term. What I mean by that is this term, if you have two charge densities and you want to write down the potential energy in classical electrodynamics, you would write that the potential energy is rho r prime divided by 4 pi epsilon naught r minus r prime. And then integrated over d cube r prime, half. This is the potential energy for two charge densities, r and r prime, and within classical electrodynamics. Now, this is how we are going to treat interactions within ions. So this gives rise to a term like this here, where this charge density is assumed to be uniform for the ions. Now, a few more tricks that we are going to use. One is that this is a function of R1 minus R2. So this is a function, and in operator space, this is just an identity operator. So it's a scalar function that commutes with these field operators. So you can pull this function, it commutes with these operators, you can move here. Note that you can't do this with this term. This is an operator that does not commute. This acts only on this. So you can't pull this, you can't put this field operator here. So with this assumption that we have charge densities, the ion-ion term looks like this. The electron-ion interaction also simplifies. We have the ionic charge density multiplied by the electronic charge, but we still have these field operators. And the electron-electron interaction term that does not have any ion density, so it remains like this. So the idea is to deal with this term, assuming that there is a uniform charge background. Now we discussed last time, like this term, we can go to the center of mass and relative coordinates, and what you will find is this can be written as this volume and an integral over relative coordinate. Let's just call this relative coordinate r again. So let's just combine terms and write it like this. So we see that there is a divergence in this ion-ion interaction potential as the distance, this relative coordinate goes to zero, there is a divergence. Let's try now to deal with this term, the electron-ion interaction. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take expectation value of this term in the ground state. So there is an issue of notation. So let me write it down first. So what I'm interested in is taking expectation value of this term in the ground state. So what this will mean is d cube r minus now, let me clarify this notation a bit. If you would see such expectation value, such an expectation value in field theory, you will say it's zero because it's vacuum. There is nothing to annihilate. In most of the condensed matter systems, this expectation value is taken in ground state. What that means is we are taking this expectation value in filled Fermi C. So we actually have a lot of electrons that can be annihilated. So this expectation value is not zero. In fact, so later today, we'll write this ground state in detail. In fact, so how do we get this ground state? So we start with many electrons. We have some dispersion relation. For example, it can be, if you just consider free electrons, you have this parabolic dispersion. Otherwise, you have some bands. Because the system has finite volume, the momentum is quantized. So if this is, say, kx, you would get some value here, some value here, some value here. So you have each state is labeled by momentum k, kx, if it's a 1D system. And then depending on how many electrons you have, you first fill the lowest electron, then the next one, then the next one, then the next one. Go on doing that till you exhaust all the electrons you have. And once you exhaust all the electrons, this state is called filled Fermi C. So actually, there are a lot of electrons that can be annihilated. And that's why this expectation value is going to be finite. And now we are going to make another approximation, which is that we'll replace this expectation value by a uniform electron density. So I'm going to replace this. Let's call this density rho electron. So with this, you can write this term as minus omega ze square rho ion, rho electron, divided by 4 pi epsilon naught. Again, after this replacement, I will go to the relative coordinate and center of mass coordinate. Integration over center of mass will give me a volume factor, but I will still be left with the integral in relative coordinate. I call this relative coordinate also r. And I note that this term also diverges as the relative coordinate goes to zero. Any questions so far? So the motivation for replacing this by a uniform electronic density that does not depend on this coordinate r, which can be taken outside this integral, is because we start with uniform ion density. So we expect that in response, electrons will also have uniform charge density. Now you would think that, okay, if electrons also have uniform charge density, ions also have uniform charge density, why can't we just treat electrons also with just classical electrodynamic interactions? The reason is that this term, we will see that this term cannot always be written in terms of density-density interactions. So let's deal with this term now. So now we take expectation value of electron-electron interactions in the ground state, which is Phil Fermi C. So here I have half sum over sigma 1, sigma 2, integral d cube r1, d cube r2. I'm going to take, so this scalar function commutes with the field operators. So let's move it here. Now I have a four-point correlation function. So I can use Wick's theorem to break it down into two-point correlation functions. And because this is a four-operator term, we know that there are two ways this can be done. So one way is I can take these two and these two. If I do these contractions, I have to move this field operator. I have to anti-commute it with this one and this one. So twice, so I get two minuses, minus signs, so the sign remains the same. The other way is if I do this one with this one, and this one with this one. Here I have to anti-commute once, so I'll get a net minus sign. So this term actually has two terms. Let's write them down. Half, sigma 1, sigma 2. I have integral d cube r1, d cube r2, e square 4 pi epsilon naught, the relative distance between them. And now I have one term which can be written as densities. So this is the first term. This can be written as the densities. And then there is another term. This other term involves different coordinates. So you have expectation value, psi sigma 1, r1, and psi sigma 2, r2. And psi sigma 2 dagger, r2, psi sigma 1, r1. So this term is what is called Hartree term. And this term is called the Fock term. Now, notice that this term, so we already said that this has R1 and R2, so this Fock term cannot be written as density, electronic density, right? It involves this R1 and R2. So even though we have assumed here that electronic density is uniform, treating electrons quantum mechanically using these field operators leaves us this term, which cannot be written in terms of electronic density. So this term is going to give us some interesting effects. We'll discuss them later this week. Look at this term. Now this term involves the same coordinates. Right? So this term actually can be written in terms of density, electronic density. In fact, this sum over sigma 1 this gives us precisely rho electron. And this other expectation value, sum over sigma 2, gives us the same thing again, right? So now I'm only going to look at the expectation value of electron, and only the Hartree term. So if I look at this, what I would find is, again, so these two are uniform, take it outside the integral, go to center of mass and relative coordinate. What you will find is that this can be written as omega by 2, e square, rho electron square, 4 pi epsilon naught, integral over relative coordinate. Here I'm calling the relative coordinate small r. We can also, let's just call it capital R. It's a coordinate that is being integrated over. It doesn't matter what variable you use. So again, this term diverges as the relative coordinate vanishes. So now we have three diverging terms. Let's add all of them. So we add the three. So the ion. Let me put expectation value for ion also, but keep in mind that this expectation value is taken in ground state for electrons. Ion interaction potential does not have any field operator, so essentially it's just identity. So even if I don't put these operators, it will be the same thing. Even if I don't put these expectation values. So let me just remove them. So I have this plus expectation value in electron ion plus expectation value electron, the Hartree term. This is omega and finally, all of them have the same divergence. So let me write down this divergence. Now let's stare at this bracket and let's see what happens if rho electron is equal to z rho ion. So if the electronic density is equal to z times rho ion, which is the ionic density, then all of these three divergences cancel. And this we know should be true if the system is charge neutral. Right? So this value of electronic density will cancel this divergence. So what we have learned here is that later on, in most of the condensed matter systems, we are going to deal with electron-electron interactions. And the electron-electron interaction term can be broken down into two terms. And this Hartree term has a divergence, but now we know that we should not be worried about this divergence, because even though we are looking at electronic correlation functions, there is a uniform charge background that will end up canceling the divergence in the Hartree term. Yes?
Why is there no Falk term when we consider the ion?
So we treat ions as just classical. So we don't treat them as indistinguishable quantum objects. So in the model, we treat ions. So you're saying there, we started with four field operators here, mm-hmm. and then in principle. So if you treat ions also quantum mechanically, the problem is a bit more complicated. And so this is just the model. So the Jellium model assumes that the ions which we know is not true, by the way. The lectures before, we insisted that ions give you a periodic potential, right? So this is just a model, and this model still gives a lot of features of electrons when we calculate. The model predicts a qualitative agreement with what we see in the experiments, so it's still a relevant model to study. Yes?
Why didn't you use like Wake theorem here? I don't understand like how it's valid in this case.
So it's if you don't want to use Wake's theorem, you can just use anti-commutation relations. This is a very simple four operator term, so you don't have to use Wake's theorem. Just use anti-commutation relation and it will break into two terms. I used it just because you learned it in QFT. It's an easier way. Yeah.
So does this mean like if you remove one of the electrons, the system blows up? Or like why?
So I would put it the other way. Then the system is no longer charge neutral. So you've created charge.
Yeah.
But if you ensure charge neutrality,
yeah.
then it must vanish.
What I'm saying is like what happens to the system? If I decide to remove one of the electrons, like I feel like the divergences should somehow still cancel.
I think you're saying if there are 10 to the power 23 electrons,
yeah.
you won't change the density by that much. So if your just fluctuations is small, I think the divergence is still. Is that what you're trying to say, or?
Well, you're saying that so long as the electron density is the same as Z times the ion density, then there's no divergence, or the divergence.
Well, yeah. there is a divergence in the Hartree term, but that should not alarm us because we know that the charge background would end up canceling it.
But if I just took this system and I removed like a bunch of electrons, I would expect the system to still be describable this way, though.
I think it would be.
So
yeah.
What do you do with the divergence in that case?
So this divergence, by the way, is coming just from this potential, right? The Coulomb potential. So there is a way to that we typically deal with such systems. And instead of this potential, we'll use what is called screened Coulomb interactions. So what that means is, so we will discuss that later. So that's another way of dealing with the divergence. So this is within the Jellium model, right? And the constraint we impose is just charge neutrality. Yep. Yes?
I mean, just like, obviously this is a much
simplified,
extremely simple model.
Yep.
Clearly, like in the ion term, ions can never be on top of each other because they're in a periodic lattice, and electrons can never be on top of each other by the exclusion principle. So, right?
So, this is true. So, as you said, this is a very simple model. It turns out that this still has excellent qualitative agreement. For example, there is a phase in condensed matter just for electrons, which is called Wigner crystal. So, which is that electrons at very low temperatures, very low energies, will form a crystalline phase on their own. So this is a crystal of electrons, not a crystal of ions. And it turns out that within this simple model, it still predicts that. And why this simple model predicts that? Well, essentially at low temperatures, electrons are trying to minimize their interaction potential, and they do this in the presence of uniform positive background, not a periodic background, but a uniform positive charge background. They do it by arranging themselves in a crystal lattice. So it is very simple model, but it is useful. That's why.
No, right. But just in terms of like these divergences are not really like a physical thing.
Yeah.
It's not like
if
you take one electron out, the system's going to explode or something.
Yeah. And this question becomes relevant when you have small number of electrons, actually. So that is another thing to focus. At the moment, we are in the limit for very large electrons. We'll consider small numbers also. But if you are thinking about corrections from QED type, like from vacuum, you're creating electron and particle, those processes are not going to have much impact. We have a lot of electrons, that's the idea. So now I would like to write this state, the state in which we took the expectation values, in a bit more detail. So let's do this by only considering the kinetic energy term. So by the way, the reason I ignored the kinetic energy of ions is just because ions are heavy. And that's also the motivation to treat them classically. So the kinetic energy term for electrons now, this term, we can also, so this is written in terms of field operators. We can also write this in terms of momentum operators. And in terms of momentum operators, we've already seen this. So I'm just going to write down the expression. Tell me if this makes sense. We did this in the first week. So simply replace the definition of field operators, and you can get this expression. Now, we are also going to impose periodic boundary conditions. What that means is we'll say that the wave function for, so the spin index, I'm just, if you look at this, if this is the only term in the Hamiltonian, does this depend on spin? No. So what that really means is that I can label states with k. So this sigma is simply nothing. This epsilon does not depend on sigma at all. So there is each case, each state that is labeled by k is doubly degenerate. That's what the spin index really does here. It will play an important role when we discuss magnetism. So periodic boundary conditions, so x plus lx, y, z. This is simply same as x, y, z. Also periodic boundary conditions in all x, y, and z. So this is x, y plus ly, z. Also same as x, y, now, periodic boundary conditions. Now, this from this, the you can deduce that the eigenstates, if you calculate the eigenstates of this Hamiltonian, in this is just the kinetic energy. So free particle p squared over 2m, the eigenstates are simply momentum eigenstates. And momentum eigenstates, we know it's plane waves. If you impose periodic boundary conditions, what you will get is basically that implies that e to the power I kxx should be equal to e to the power I kx x plus lx, which simply implies e to the power I kx lx should be 1. Now, this, whenever you have a finite system, you will always get, you have to impose some boundary conditions. If you have a finite system, you have to know what happens at the boundary. Once you impose boundary conditions, you would find that momentum would get quantized. It will only take discrete values. And in this case, this is straightforward, that this condition implies that kx is 2 pi divided by lx, some integer nx. Similarly, you'll find nkz 2 pi over the length in z direction, nz. So here nx, ny, and nz, these are integers. Now this energy, this is simply a parabolic dispersion. So let's plot this. So now this energy is function of k. I'm plotting it only in kx direction. So I know kx takes these values. I can choose these integers n, so it can be 0. So there's a state here. It can be 1. So this is, say, 1, 2, 3. So basically, I'm making equally spaced values on the x-coordinate. And this is, the spacing is 2 pi over lx. And these integers, they can also be negative. So they probably don't appear equally spaced, but imagine they're equally spaced. The spacing is 2 pi over lx. Now, depending on how many electrons you have, these states are going to be occupied. And I'm denoting, let's denote them by these. Filled out, and after a certain energy level, for example, let's say this is filled, this is filled, you run out of electrons, or you've filled the entire system, used up all the electrons there are going to be states that are not occupied. So from this point on, you will have states that are not occupied. So this energy level is called the Fermi energy. Now, another concept that would be useful is, I think you probably saw this in statistical mechanics also, is if from here we can calculate what is the volume per state in K space. So the volume per state in K in X, so that is basically the volume that this state occupies in K space. So it's pi over LX here, pi over LX here. So this volume is actually 2 pi cube LX LY LZ. This is just the volume in phase space, right? I can also draw this in the following way. So these are just some states in K space. So they're all supposed to be equally spaced. And this is say kx, this is ky. And you can, when you fill all the occupied states, so in kx, ky, and kz equal to 0 space, this will look like a circle if lx and ly are same. So in three-dimensional space, if you imagine equally spaced points in kx, ky, and kz space, and you start filling up this state space with electrons, once you run out of all of the electrons, what you will have is a sphere. Inside the sphere, all of the dots are occupied. Outside the sphere, all of the dots are empty. This sphere is called Fermi sphere. And the radius of this Fermi sphere is denoted as KF. So inside this Fermi sphere, all of the states are occupied, and each K state can take two spin values. So the state 0, this can be written as all K vectors less than KF. CK up dagger, CK down dagger. Now we have, say, true vacuum. So this is actually the state in which we are calculating those expectation values. So there are a lot of electrons. Any questions so far? Okay. So now, next, what we want to see is when our interactions, or we want to analyze and try to figure out when are electron-electron interactions relevant, or when are electron-electron interactions important? When can we treat the system non-interacting? And when should we worry about interactions? So to do this, what we are going to do is we are going to calculate in this Hamiltonian, in this system, in this state, average kinetic energy per particle and average potential energy per particle. So this KF, using the Fermi momentum KF, you can define Fermi wavelength. Lambda F, which is just 2 pi over KF. You can also define what is called Fermi velocity. And this Fermi velocity, VF, is defined as 1 over h bar, derivative of energy with respect to momentum, calculated at kf. So this comes out to be h bar kf divided by m. So next, we can calculate what is the total number of electrons. So we know that the total number of electrons can be written like this. So it's basically expectation value of the number operator. So again, what we have to do is we have to take expectation value in this state. Now we can see that you annihilate a particle and you create a particle again. Whenever the k is such that it's occupied, k is such that it's less than kf, it will contribute 1. Otherwise, when k is greater than kf, the states are unoccupied, the expectation value will be 0, right? So this thing, also notice that sigma, it does nothing. Everything is twice degenerate. So I will put a factor of 2 outside for spin. And all I have left to do is sum over all k, sum over k over all occupied states. Right? Now, we can simply guess the answer. It's going to be the volume of the Fermi sphere, right? So let's do one more step because this trick is used a lot. So you can convert a sum over k. Yes?
When we were computing the expectation value of the interaction, the electron-electron, we cannot use Weak theorem if we are computing the expectation value in the true vacuum, right? We cannot use Weak's theorem in the Fermi vacuum.
So there is a general version. I think this is a nomenclature in the sense that there. All I'm doing here is just using anti-commutation relation to move the.
Yes, but you move them around until you have the annihilation operator acting on the vacuum. But then it's not zero because it's not a true vacuum.
No.
So you should have more terms.
So I should. What I'm doing here is just a way of pairing. All I've done here is a way of pairing an annihilation and creation operator. And if you want, we will do what we should really do is we should use Weak's theorem by writing this expression. Consider all of the operators, write those field operators in terms of their momentum decomposition, and then you will have all of these operators also. And these are all going to be daggers. On the other side, on the bra, you will get the annihilation operators. And in principle, then you should use Weak's theorem. This is just the result. The same result is obtained if I pair these two. So we'll discuss Hartree-Fock in detail when we do mean field theory. But the detailed process is the following. So you replace all of them by these operators and then use Weak's theorem. You will have a whole series of...
But what, you have more terms?
Yeah, so you would have...
You would have contractions of the annihilation of...
Yeah, so you would have more terms and there would be cancellations. You would expect... So there will be many terms. The terms that will contribute will be the fully contracted ones. There will be many ways. As you said, there are going to be many terms. But in the end, these will be the only terms that will contribute. So I will write down the full expression in... next 2 days. But the entire process does involve many operators. This is just the simplified result for the moment. And the whole reason for this is just to say that if there is a divergence in the Hartree term, we should not worry about it. So now here, the sum over k can be converted into an integral. And we can write this as 2. So the sum over k can be written as the volume integral in k space divided by 2 pi cube. And now this integral is for all k values less than kf. So this is simply going to give you 4 by 3 pi kf cube. So the result is omega 3 pi square kf cube. So this is an electron. You can see that that means we can write down the Fermi wave vector, Kf, in terms of, now this n electron divided by volume is the electron density. So we can write down this Fermi wave vector in terms of the electron density. So I can write this as 3 pi square rho electron cube root. Now, the Fermi energy itself can be written as h bar square kf square over 2m. So this is h bar square over 2m. So the Fermi energy can also be written in terms of electron density. Now let's calculate the expectation value of the kinetic energy. So what we want to calculate is the total kinetic energy. And the total kinetic energy is sum over k sigma h bar square k square over 2m. Now this can be written as 4 pi k square. So you'll see you will have k to the power 4. And when you integrate it, and you can see that this can be written as h bar kf square over 2m times omega kf cube divided by 5 pi square. Now this kf cube can be written in terms of electron density, and when I plug everything in, I will get this is 3 over 5 times the Fermi energy multiplied by n electrons. Now, what I want to calculate is average kinetic energy. Per particle. Now, average kinetic energy per particle is just divided by the total number of electrons. So this is 3 over 5 times the Fermi energy. Now, what this means is that the average and kinetic energy per particle goes as electron density to the power 2 by 3. Right? Now, the potential energy, let's also calculate average potential energy per particle. Let's assume that the average distance between electrons is d bar. Let's say this is the average distance between electrons. So how does this d bar? This simply means that now the total density can be written as the volume given by this d bar. So you can see that this average distance is, you can just think of this as the density minus 1 by 3. So the idea is total number of electrons is basically rho electron, the density multiplied by the volume. Right? So the total number of electrons will be total volume divided by this average distance, which is basically omega times rho electron. So now the potential energy, it depends on, so the average potential energy between two particles, would two electrons, would be simply E square over 4 pi epsilon naught, the average distance, D bar. This implies that the average potential energy, this goes as rho electron minus 1 by 3. So when we take the ratio, we see that the ratio of potential energy this ratio is actually rho, so actually D bar is minus 1 by 3, so you get plus 1 by 3 here. So this ratio is rho electron minus 1 by 3. Now, what this result means is that if you have high density of electrons, in that case, you can ignore the electron-electron interactions. So this is a counterintuitive result. You would expect that if the density of electrons is very high, that this distance is small and potential energy should be relevant. However, what is important is the ratio of kinetic energy and potential energy. And from this analysis, we deduce that actually when electron density is smaller, that's when the effect of potential energy dominate the effects of kinetic energy. Now, the kinetic energy includes non-interacting terms. So the effect of interactions is relevant when you have electron gas with low density. So this counterintuitive fact, it simply comes because of Pauli exclusion principle. So now let's talk about another concept that is useful when we are dealing with the electrons, particularly in bands, is the concept of density of states. And you would do some problems in the tutorial today. So we can use this notation. The density of states rho of epsilon, it's a function of energy. And the definition of density of states is the number of states at a given energy. So the number of states between energy epsilon and epsilon plus d epsilon. So number of states . This is defined as the density of states. So you can write down a formula for it. This is basically the derivative of the number per unit volume as a function of energy. So this n is total number of states divided by the volume. Now, this should be a function of energy. So the how many states you have, how many occupied states you have. So typically, depending on the energy of system, you will have this number of states. And you can just take the derivative of it. So we can do a quick example. So
total number of states. This total number of states. This is given by 2 for spin times volume in K space, divided by the volume per space, volume per state. So this you can calculate as 2 4/3 pi kf cube. By cube by omega, you'll find out that this is omega 3 pi square kf cube. Now, the Fermi energy is
it can also be written in terms of kf. So we can write from this equation n divided by omega is n. So we can write that kf is 3 pi square n
So the Fermi energy, this can be written as h bar square 2m 3 pi square n to the power 2/3.
And now you can invert this. What you will find is that n, this can be written as and now we can take the derivative and we'll find that rho e. So first I'm applying all this for Fermi energy. And then here I say, because it's a symmetric system, so n as a function of energy is depends on energy as 3/2. Now I can take the derivative. So we find that density of states for electrons in 3 dimensions, it goes as square root of E. In the tutorial, you'll do it for 2D and 1D. And also you would apply this to a band structure where there is a saddle point in the band structure. So there is another definition of density of states, which is useful. So this is one definition, dN over dE. You can also write density of states as a factor of 2 for spin. Integrate over in momentum space. And then a delta function E minus EK.
So what this delta function does is this integral will contribute 1 if the energy as a function of k is equal to E. So because I have epsilon here, let's put epsilon. So basically all values of k which have same energy E contribute 1 to this integral. And basically you are summing over all states in k space that have the same energy E. So you're basically calculating the number of states. So this from using starting this from this definition, you can also convert this integral into an integral over a constant energy surface. And write this as gradient in momentum space over energy. So this integral is over SE.
So this integral is a surface integral. It's an integral over surface of constant energy in K space. So there are many definitions which are all related, and depending on the system you have, one of them might be more easier than the other. So in the tutorial today, you will use you will apply this concept to some of the one or two problems. So now we are going to discuss. So far, we assumed that these ions. So we have treated two models. One, we discussed when the ions arrange themselves in a periodic lattice. And the second model, where ions are just uniformly, provide a uniform background charge density. Typically, these ions are going to vibrate at their position. So far, we have ignored any dynamics of these ions. And when these ions vibrate, we can quantize these vibrations, and these quantized vibrations are called phonons. Phonons play a very important role in condensed matter. You can understand sound, propagation of sound in a material. So there is wave-particle duality for the sound waves. You can understand the quantized version using phonons. You can also understand specific heat of a material using phonons. One of the most important things is, or one of the celebrated phenomena in condensed matter is superconductivity. And we'll see that typically electrons repel each other, but phonons provide a channel for attraction between two electrons. So phonons play a very important role. And next 1.5 or 2 lectures, we are going to talk about phonons and then derive an interaction between electrons mediated by phonons. So one of the simplest models for phonons is using this Jellium model. And this was used by Einstein in 1906 or 7. And the idea here is to explain the specific heat that was measured for various solids. So let's take that Jellium model. And in the Jellium model so far, we assume that the ionic charge density is uniform. Now, because the ions can vibrate, let's assume that these vibrations are small. But because they can vibrate, this can give rise to a density that depends on, now is no longer uniform, and it depends on time. So this rho naught ion is the ionic density that we assumed in the Jellium model. And now in this Einstein model for phonons, we are going to add to this a small term that depends on R and has a harmonic dependence on time. And the reason for adding this term to the Jellium model ionic density is because we are assuming that the ions are vibrating. Now, when you have a charge density, so this is the density. You can convert this to a charge density. And this additional charge density, so let me write additional, that comes from this additional density is just multiplied by charge of ions. So it's ZE delta rho ion. Now we know using, so let me write down the Maxwell equations. So just let's just look at this one. So del dot E is rho over epsilon naught. So we have an additional charge density, which comes because ions are vibrating. So this additional charge density is going to provide an is going to create an electric field that is given by this, by the Maxwell equation. So we have this can be written as ZE over epsilon naught delta rho ion R per minus I omega t. Now this electric field is going to exert a force on the charge density itself. Yes?
The omega exponential, that's completely different to the volume one we're using.
Oh yeah, so yeah, that's a good point. So this is frequency. Let me put omega j here. So this is frequency. So later on, this omega would become the plasma frequency for the ions. Yes.
Isn't it better if you use another letter?
So you'd get to choose.
It's going to be a mess.
Sorry?
Prefer it not to become a mess.
Okay. So let's, how about small omega? Okay. So this electric field is going to exert a force, and this force can be calculated by just the charge times the electric field. Now I'm going to do densities. So this is a force density. So this force density is again going to be Z E rho naught ion times E. So what we have done here is we have an additional charge density. This additional charge density creates an electric field, and now this electric field exerts a force on what was there before. So this is the effect of additional charge density on the homogeneous charge density that we started with. Now here we can take the gradient on both sides. So let's, so we have this expression. We can take the gradient on both sides. Okay, I'll just write it down here. So the gradient F, and then use the Maxwell equation, we'll get it's Z square, E square, rho naught ion divided by epsilon naught, delta rho ion e to the power minus I omega t. And next, we are going to demand conservation of charge. Now, conservation of charge is going to give us the continuity equation, which would say that the time derivative of the ionic density, rho ion. Now, this is the full density, R and t. Let's just write it down, R, t. Plus the gradient of current density should vanish. So now J is current density. We can write this current density J as some velocity times the charge density. Right? And now we are going to make an approximation. So let's put this back in. So what we have is time derivative of rho ion RT. This is the gradient. So you have gradient of the velocity. So this rho ion, this can be written as rho naught ion plus now, when we take the gradient, there are going to be two terms. We are going to ignore the second one. And the reason is the following. This term includes, is of lower, is smaller or negligible
because it includes product of two terms. This is small. This is assumed to be small because we assume that ions vibrate a little bit around their equilibrium position. So we expect this density to be much smaller compared to the density that we started with. Because of this additional charge density that gave us some electric field, and because of that, there is some additional velocity. So the dynamics is coming from this small variation itself. So the velocity is also small. So we ignore this term. And also what we will do, so this term can be ignored. Now we can take time derivative of this equation. So what we end up with is del t square. Now notice that the time dependence is only here. And now we can use Newton's second law. This del TV can be written in terms of force. So we know that the force density should be mass density times the derivative of velocity. Now we already have an expression for, so we have del dot, using this we can write F. We have an expression for del dot F. When we put that back in, we'll find that minus omega square delta rho ion R this equation, so we have e to the power minus I omega t, it cancels. So we can calculate this frequency, omega. And this frequency comes out to be z square, e square, rho naught ion divided by epsilon naught m. And this frequency is called ionic plasma frequency. What that means is it describes charge density oscillations of the ionic plasma, or basically charge density oscillations of the ions. This frequency does not depend on K. So you could, that will become important only later on. So this is the expression that Einstein got. And then he said like, okay, we know, now let's quantize these vibrations. So once you quantize these vibrations, he wrote down, he assumed that the phonon Hamiltonian can be written as sum over Q H bar omega. Let's get this omega here, Q dagger BQ plus half. And using this Hamiltonian, you can calculate the specific heat, and it will give you some prediction, and then we can see whether the prediction agrees with the experiment or not. But at that time, there was only the Dulong and Petit law for the specific heat, which is basically, you also saw in StatMech, in classical thermodynamics, we say that at thermal equilibrium, each degree of freedom contributes an energy of half kBT, where kB is the Boltzmann factor. Now, if you have an ion with n ions, so total number of degrees of freedom. It will be number of ions.
Now each ion has three kinetic energy degrees of freedom. That's half mvx square, vy square, vz square. And each ion also has three potential energy degrees of freedom, that is vibrations in three different directions. Now these vibrations you can think of as mass attached to a spring. So the potential energy is like the spring potential energy. So there are 3 degrees of freedom for the potential energy. So there are total 6 degrees of freedom. And each degree of freedom contributes half kBT. This is the total energy. So you can calculate specific heat at constant volume as the temperature derivative of this. And you'll find that this is an ion's times kB. So most of the materials agree with this formula, that the specific heat at constant volume does not depend on temperature at higher temperatures. At lower temperatures, this turns out to be incorrect. At lower temperatures, in fact, the third law of thermodynamics says that the specific heat at constant volume must vanish as T goes to zero. So this, there must be something incorrect here, which is, you can reconcile this by saying that at lower temperatures, the degrees of freedoms of the ions freeze out. So you no longer have, so this degrees of freedom that we assume 3 for kinetic, 3 kinetic, 3 potential, these degrees of freedom freeze out at lower temperature. And as a result, CV goes to zero. So using this model for phonons, we'll calculate this. And there is another model called Debye model, which also includes quantized version of phonons. We can calculate the specific heat, and we'll see that we get a prediction that goes to zero as temperature goes to zero. So next we want to do classical theory of vibrations. So I can simply sketch. I can sketch the idea. So we can do this here. So now we are going to treat ions in a lattice. So far, this Einstein photons, phonons, this was using the Jellium model. That's uniform ionic density. In principle, as pointed out already, we know, even from experiments, that ions are, they typically arrange themselves in a periodic lattice. So let's assume that this the lattice constant is A. So the direct lattice vector is simply some integer n times the primitive lattice vector A. And the primitive lattice vector A is just the lattice constant A along x direction. And what we are going to assume, so let's say this is nA. This is n plus 1a. This is n plus, let me write it above. So this is nA. So what that means is n is some integer corresponding to the direct lattice vector. This is n plus 1a. This is n plus 2a. N plus 3a. This is n minus 1a. N minus 2a, and so on. Now, these dots, the lattice, this represents the equilibrium position of ions. each ion is vibrating. So at any given instant, can you see this line? Can it be moved up? Okay. So at any given instant of time, these ions are not going to be, for a general instant of time, they're not going to be at their equilibrium position, but they're going to be, so these crosses now denote the position of the ions. So at any given instant of time, these ions need not be at their equilibrium position. And for a given ion, this displacement from the equilibrium position, this will be denoted by U and A. So U is the displacement of the ion at n times A. And this can be different for different ions. And next, we are going to start with the interaction potential between ions. We are just going to consider this as a potential energy as a function of distance between the ions. And we'll use Taylor expansion around the equilibrium position and get the lowest order terms in these displacements U. So keep in mind that the system is still periodic overall, but there are small vibrations. So this U is much smaller than, for example, the lattice constant, A. OK, so we'll continue tomorrow with the theory of phonons.